Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're going to unpack one of the most, let's say, polarizing and honestly fascinating figures in American politics right now. Caroline Leavitt.
It's a really important conversation to have.
It is. We have a ton of material here covering her, well, her meteoric rise, this highly scrutinized personal life, and a communication style that has, I think, fundamentally redefined the role of the White House press secretary.
It really has.
So the central question we're asking is she truly the new first lady of power?
And that's a fascinating label, because when you hear it, you think of policy, you think of traditional influence. But with her, it's something different.
Exactly.
And the sheer speed of her career is just staggering. I mean, she was appointed White House press secretary at just 27 years old. She turned 28 shortly after taking the job.
27.
Which makes her the youngest person in history to hold that position. By a long shot.
That fact alone is a total head snapper.
Right.
You just have to stop and think about that. How does a Gen Z woman from New Hampshire, whose background includes college softball and working at her family's ice cream stand,
right.
How does she make that leap almost instantly into one of the highest profile, most stressful political jobs in the entire world by the time she's barely out of her mid-20s?
Mm.
It defies all the normal rules.
It completely defies them. Her rise wasn't about climbing some traditional ladder, not at all. It was more like a rocket launch. And it was fueled entirely by fierce loyalty and a very specific pre-existing political identity.
Right.
We're looking at someone who really arrived in Washington with this fully formed combative persona that was just, well, it was perfectly tailored for this administration.
And the administration didn't try to smooth her edges or anything. They put her front and center, you know, as the designated warrior.
Oh, absolutely.
We hear her described constantly as the battle-tested bad cop, yeah. Someone who is openly a sworn enemy of the fake news.
And that's the key distinction. While the president might have what some sources call a seemingly more relaxed personal relationship with certain media figures now, Leavitt is the one who's tasked with that daily pugilistic energy in the public eye.
She's the counterpuncher.
She is the designated counterpuncher. Her job isn't just to relay information, it's to actively confront the entire journalistic institution itself. And that right there is what gives her this outsized influence. It gives her narrative power.
So when we talk about her being a first lady of power, we're not talking about policy influence.
No, not in the traditional sense. We're talking about narrative control. She dictates the terms of engagement. She's the one defining who's legitimate in that briefing room and, well, who isn't.
And it's so fascinating that her actual physical placement in the West Wing seems to underscore this whole dynamic.
Tell me about that.
She wasn't given the traditional spacious press secretary office. That office actually went to the Deputy Chief of Staff for Communications, Taylor Budowich.
That's a crucial architectural detail, isn't it? I mean, it really tells you something.
It does. It suggests her role is strategically defined less by, you know, internal coordination and more by external combat.
Right. By giving that traditional office, which is kind of the communications nerve center, to someone else, it positions Leavitt's role as the public-facing lightning rod.
She's the executor.
Exactly. She's the one who takes the political heat, delivers the rhetorical attacks, while the strategic communications machine operates, you know, adjacent to her, not necessarily through her daily briefings.
Okay, that sets the stage perfectly. So today, we're diving deep into her background, her campaign history, which, by the way, includes a pretty significant financial controversy, and then the intense scrutiny around her unconventional personal life.
Especially her marriage and her approach to motherhood.
Yes. And then we'll spend a lot of time dissecting the specific, often explosive media clashes that really define her day-to-day job. So let's start at the beginning. Let's unpack this career path.
Let's do it. Let's start with her foundation. Caroline Claire Leavitt was born on August 24th, 1997. She was born in Atkinson, New Hampshire.
So truly Gen Z.
Absolutely. Youngest of four children. And her background is rooted firmly in small business. You see that classic New England entrepreneurial spirit. Her family owned an ice cream stand, and her father runs a used truck dealership.
A very grounded, small-town American upbringing. And she was the first person in her immediate family to graduate from college. She went to St. Anselm College, majored in communications, minored in political science.
And she was a scholarship softball player for her first 2 years. That drive, that competitive spirit, it seems pretty evident early on.
It does. But what's really telling, I think, is how early her political identity solidified, specifically her distrust of the media.
Right. She described herself as the token conservative on campus, and even before she graduated, she was already formalizing these views in public.
I really want to focus on that key piece of material from 2016. She wrote an opinion piece for the student paper, the St. Anselm Crier. And this wasn't just some generic political rant.
No, it wasn't.
It was almost a preemptive philosophical justification for the career she would later have.
Absolutely. It's the blueprint. In that 2016 piece, she argued that the media was, and I'm quoting here, frankly crooked, unjust, unfair, and sometimes just plain old false.
And think about the timing of that. 2016.
Exactly. This sets the foundation for her whole fake news stance years before she was even working in the White House. For her, this wasn't just a talking point she adopted for her career.
No, it's a core belief.
It was a deeply held conviction she formed in college. This makes her incredibly authentic to the movement she now represents, because she sees the media not as an institution to inform, but as a political entity to be fought.
That early alignment, it clearly streamlined her entry into politics. She graduates in 2019 and immediately joins the White House staff.
Right away. Started in the Office of Presidential Correspondence, you know, drafting letters and notes for the president.
A classic entry point.
A classic entry point, but she moved swiftly. By June of 2020, so just a year later, she had already risen to Assistant White House Press Secretary, serving under Kayleigh McEnany.
So she got firsthand experience in that communication shop during the very, very tumultuous time.
Say the least. And that period included the early White House COVID-19 outbreak. She was right in the middle of all of it.
The Rose Garden ceremony.
She was there. She attended that now infamous outdoor nomination ceremony for Amy Coney Barrett, which, as you said, became known as a major super spreader event. And she subsequently tested positive for the virus herself.
Which politically just further cements her as a loyalist who was literally on the front lines, even risking her health for the administration.
Exactly. And after the 2020 election, she didn't stray far. She stayed firmly in the orbit, serving as communications director for Congresswoman Elise Stefanik.
Another staunch defender of the president.
Right. But her next move was a real political test for her. She decided to run for Congress herself.
Back home in New Hampshire.
The 2022 run for New Hampshire's first congressional district was crucial. She went home and positioned herself as the most fervent, the most pro-Trump candidate in that Republican primary. This wasn't a campaign about, you know, moderate compromise.
No, it was a full embrace of the Mangier identity. And she leveraged her White House ties immediately.
Precisely. She got endorsements from major figures like Senator Ted Cruz, Congressman Jim Jordan, and of course her former boss, Elise Stefanik.
And that loyalty paid off in the primary.
It did. She won with 34.6% of the vote, defeating Matt Mowers, who was kind of painted as insufficiently loyal. So that primary win, it just validated the idea that extreme loyalty was the key currency in the party.
But the general election against the incumbent Democrat, Chris Pappas, that proved to be tougher terrain.
Much tougher. She lost, taking 45.9% of the vote. And it was during this campaign that we see a major financial controversy emerge. This is a detail that often gets glossed over, but I think it speaks volumes.
I think we need to unpack this because it really highlights the administration's, let's say, prioritization of loyalty over standard compliance.
It really does. So after she lost the election, she filed a staggering 17 amended filings with the Federal Election Commission, the FEC. 17. And these disclosed over $326,000 in unpaid campaign debts.
Okay, so for our listeners who might not be familiar, what exactly is the FEC? And why is this level of debt and this kind of disclosure so serious?
So the FEC is the independent agency that regulates campaign finance in the U.S. And this isn't just about being bad at budgeting. The crucial part here is that roughly $200,000 of that debt was made up of illicit campaign contributions.
What does that mean, illicit?
It means donations made in excess of the legal limits, which she never repaid. This is a direct violation of campaign finance law, and it resulted in an official FEC complaint being filed against her campaign.
So she knowingly accepted money beyond the legal limit, didn't repay it, and then only disclosed it much later through all these corrections. In a different political world, a controversy that significant, a major campaign finance violation, could easily derail a career.
It would be the end of a career, absolutely. Yet despite the election loss and this financial scrutiny, her pathway back to the political inner circle was completely unimpeded.
Which is the profound insight here.
Right. In this specific political sphere, adherence to the mission and that fierce advocacy, it outweighs almost any transgression related to compliance or fundraising technicalities or even electoral success.
She proved she was battle-tested and loyal. And that was just deemed more valuable than a clean campaign finance record. Her value was her voice.
Exactly. Her value was her voice, not her administrative clean slate. She pivoted seamlessly back into the campaign structure, serving as spokesperson for MAGACE Inc., the president's super PAC.
And then came the big promotion.
Then in January 2024, she becomes the national press secretary for the campaign itself, which put her directly in the media war room for that crucial election year.
And in the appointment in November 2024, White House press secretary, at 27, taking the historical record. But let's go back to that physical detail you mentioned earlier, the smaller office. Why is that specific detail so powerful in defining her role?
Because it's all about strategic intent. It's a signal. By placing the operational comms chief, Taylor Budowich, in that large traditional press secretary office, the administration is telling you that the strategic control is separate from the public-facing combat.
So her smaller office implies her primary function isn't to manage internal messaging, but to execute the president's will in that briefing room.
Yes. She is the public face of the conflict. She is the shock trooper, not the logistical planner.
That dynamic is so crucial because it suggests she has the freedom to be maximally combative without having to worry about, you know, managing the complex policy realities behind the scenes. That's someone else's job.
She is free to be the public lightning rod.
And being that public lightning rod means your entire life, everything, is placed under this intense microscope. Which brings us to her personal world.
Right, and that has generated an enormous amount of chatter, particularly about her unconventional marriage and her approach to motherhood.
Okay, let's talk about that relationship. She's married to Nicholas Riccio. He's a New Hampshire real estate developer, and there is a 32-year age gap between them. She is 28, and he is 60.
That's a substantial gap. And they met during her 2022 congressional campaign at a restaurant he owns. It is, by her own admission, an atypical love story.
So how has she navigated the public attention on that age difference? Because in the age of social media, a gap like that is just fodder for endless speculation and, you know, criticism.
She's handled it by leaning into the sincerity of the relationship while also providing this really crucial context. She describes him as her rock, her best friend, and her greatest supporter.
I've seen that.
And critically, she often highlights his professional stability. As the owner of a company that manages beachfront property, his flexible schedule and his successful business were key factors that allowed her to dedicate herself fully to this incredibly demanding, high-travel political career.
So his established life provided the platform for her accelerated ambition.
That's a perfect way to put it. His existing professional stability enables her professional agility. It makes perfect sense, given the sheer unpredictability of White House life.
Right.
She also describes him as an introvert and her opposite, which she says explains why he often seeks privacy. But that desire for privacy, combined with the age gap and her high-profile job, just created a perfect storm for online scrutiny.
And that scrutiny often turns really harsh and politically motivated. I mean, we're talking about online rumors and jokes, some of them explicitly linking her perceived penchant for older men to her fiercely loyal professional relationship with the president.
It's a cruel way to fuse the personal and the political. It is the brutal reality of operating in the digital public square today, especially for a controversial figure.
And that scrutiny really hit a peak recently with some accusations about a family Halloween photo she posted on Instagram.
Ah, yes. The accusations were that she was airbrushing or photoshopping her husband's face.
To make him look younger.
Yes. Critics carefully compared the photo she posted on social media, which had this very smooth, filtered look, with professional press photographs taken at the same White House event. The accusation was that she had actively photoshopped his face to make him appear significantly younger.
I remember seeing one comment that just circulated everywhere.
The one that said the smoothing filter on her old man's forehead working overtime.
That's the one. It is intensely personal, and it just speaks volumes about the modern political ecosystem where even a family photo is dissected for evidence of manipulation.
It shows that everything is performance. And in response to that wave of criticism, she then appeared to hide or crop out her husband's face in later family photos on Instagram.
Seemingly to respect his privacy as an introvert.
Right. But the optics, the damage to the optics was already done. And those optics extend to her entire social media presence. The content she presents is a very calculated narrative.
It's a study in professional dedication.
It really is. Critics consistently point out that her Instagram feed is just overwhelmingly dominated by photos of the president, who she calls the boss.
And the captions are very much like heavy fangirling.
Most transparent president in history, briefing the boss, constantly reinforcing her loyalty, and this adoration of her political leader, when you juxtapose it with the relative scarcity of photos of her own husband, it just fuels that external speculation about where her professional focus truly lies.
She's curating a persona where her identity is almost entirely subsumed by her dedication to the political movement.
Absolutely. And that dedication was demonstrated in the most extreme fashion imaginable with the birth of their son, Nicholas Robert Riccio, or Nico, in July of 2024.
This detail really brings the level of commitment home for the listener.
This is truly unprecedented, and frankly, it's shocking. She returned to work for a television appearance just 4 days after giving birth.
4 days. She was offered a full month of paid parental leave, but she only requested 10 days. And then she cut even that short.
It raises serious questions about the professional expectations she's setting, not just for herself, but by extension, for other working mothers in that administration.
It does. On the surface, the story is about dedication. The immediate catalyst was the attempted assassination of the president, which happened just 3 days after Nico was born.
Right. She said she felt compelled to be present in this historic moment. She argued that if the president literally put his life on the line, the least she could do was rush back to work.
But if we look at the political calculation here, there's a really powerful statement being made. She's prioritizing the political movement over personal recovery, over standard postpartum care. I mean, what message does that send?
It sends a message that loyalty and political combat are paramount, that they supersede even essential physical recovery. While some people might see it as heroic dedication, others see it critically. They worry it establishes this unsustainable, even dangerous precedent for high-achieving working women.
She basically chose to weaponize her own sacrifice.
She did. To show that her commitment transcends basic human needs. That single act tells you everything you need to know about the intensity she brings to her daily professional life.
And that level of intensity, it translates directly into her day-to-day political combat behind the podium.
Yes. This is where we see the Gen Z enforcer at her most potent. When she steps into that briefing room, she completely rejects the notion that the press secretary is an arbiter of facts.
Or a conveyor of transparent information.
Not at all. She views the media as a political obstacle. She's constantly reinforcing the narrative that the media is a leftist propaganda machine and fake news.
The strategy seems to be, don't engage with the substance of the question. Attack the credibility of the person asking it.
Precisely. And her attacks aren't just limited to policy disagreements. They often target the personal or, you know, the cognitive capacity of her political opponents. Let's look at the specific clashes because they follow a specific rhetorical blueprint.
Okay, let's start with the cognitive attacks on former President Biden.
These are classic rhetorical strikes designed to undermine legitimacy. She made these pointed public comments about his schedule, stating, I'm shocked that he's speaking at nighttime. I have thought his bedtime was much earlier.
And she's explicitly called him cognitively impaired.
Repeatedly. While at the same time asserting that President Trump is in optimal physical health, this strategy aims to draw a clear contrast. Frail, weak opposition versus a vigorous, healthy leader.
But the personal attacks aren't just for political rivals. She brings that exact same hostility directly to reporters, even in private messages. That HuffPost text exchange is just a stunning example of the breakdown of decorum.
That exchange was truly unprecedented for someone in her role. A HuffPost reporter messaged her privately asking about a highly sensitive detail, the location of an upcoming meeting between the president and Vladimir Putin in Budapest.
And her reply was just astonishingly crude.
Your mom did.
It's an insult you'd expect to hear on a high school playground, not from the chief spokesperson for the president of the United States.
Exactly. It speaks to a complete intentional shattering of professional boundaries. And she followed it up by calling the journalist a far-left hack who nobody takes seriously.
So that moment tells you everything. She doesn't just disagree with the press.
No, she holds them in absolute contempt. And she is willing to use dismissive, non-professional language to prove it. She views the role not as a gatekeeper of information, but as a political troll designed to antagonize her opponents.
And that perception guides her when she has to address sensitive policy details, like the president's own health.
Oh, yeah.
When she was pressed about the specifics of his physical examination, she had to defend why an MRI, which is not standard for a routine physical of him, was performed.
That was a major transparency challenge for her. Reporters immediately noted that advanced imaging like an MRI suggests doctors were looking for something specific, right?
Yes.
So Leavitt's defense was consistent. She clarified that the advanced imaging was part of a routine physical examination and that the results showed exceptional physical health. But she never provided the key piece of context.
Why the MRI was ordered in the first place?
Never. She just deflected by saying she would check back. It's a classic move. Say the results are great. Deny the reason for the test.
And she applies that same aggressive framing to international media as well. She extends the fake news argument beyond U.S. borders.
Look at her sharp attack on the BBC, one of the world's most respected news organizations. She called it a leftist propaganda machine that is unfortunately subsidized by British taxpayers.
And she went on to fully support a lawsuit against them.
Yes, filed by the president's external counsel, claiming the BBC engaged in purposeful and dishonest editing of a speech. Her message is clear. The administration's media war is global. No journalistic entity is immune to that propaganda machine label.
This combative approach isn't just tolerated within the administration. It's celebrated. We actually saw external validation of this strategy from a major foreign leader.
That moment with Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán was so revealing. During a bilateral meeting, Leavitt launched into this impromptu, aggressive defense of the president's economic record. She felt reporters weren't covering the wins.
So after witnessing her passionate, confrontational defense, Orbán.
Orbán jokingly asked the president if he could hire her.
That's powerful political currency. When an anti-establishment foreign leader praises your spokesperson's aggressive style, it validates the strategy as globally effective for populist leaders.
And this translates into her ability to completely control the room. She uses that authority to just shut down questions. We saw that when she told an Associated Press reporter she regretted giving them a question after they pressed her on economic claims she was making.
It's not just deflection. It's a display of power. She's telling the press that access is conditional upon compliance.
She is setting a new, aggressively limited standard for interaction.
And this daily combativeness, it becomes exponentially more complicated when she has to manage these massive policy crises where the president's own public statements conflict with the legal or operational realities of the government.
The 43-day government shutdown and the chaos around SNIP benefits is the perfect illustration of this dual reality she has to manage.
The conflict started with a very unambiguous statement from the president on Truth Social.
It did. The president explicitly posted that SNIP benefits would be given only when the radical left Democrats open up government, and not before. He was openly using food assistance as a bargaining chip.
But just hours later, Leavitt had to go out and contradict him by stating the administration was, in fact, complying with a court order to pay at least partial benefits by tapping a contingency fund.
So she had to deal with the immediate fallout of the president's public posture colliding with legal reality. Her initial pivot was a bit weak. She tried to argue his post was about future payments, but then she quickly shifted to her preferred mode.
Aggression and external blame.
Exactly. She attacked the judicial system. She called the judge who mandated the payments, Judge Boasberg, unhinged, and his ruling judicial overreach at its finest.
She turned the necessary compliance into an attack on the administration. And she didn't stop at calling the judge unhinged. She went after his political background.
Yes, she highlighted that Judge Boasberg was a Democrat activist appointed by Barack Obama. She noted his wife had donated over $10,000 to Democratic causes. Then she claimed the court was forcing the executive branch to rob the Children Nutrition Fund to pay for SNIP benefits.
So the strategy is brilliantly executed in a way. When reality conflicts with the president's statement, she aligns the administration's necessary action with the president's will by blaming a biased, activist, external enemy.
She maintains loyalty while explaining reality. It manages the conflict by constantly reinforcing this narrative of a besieged administration fighting powerful, illegitimate forces. And we saw this exact pattern again when she dealt with the firestorm over the Jeffrey Epstein files.
Those emails, which mentioned the president multiple times, created an immediate political crisis.
And she reacted with extreme speed, defining the issue immediately as a political weapon. She framed the like as another distraction campaign by the Democrat in the liberal media. She made the story about media bias, not the content of the files.
And what was the core substance of her defense, regarding the president's relationship with Epstein.
Her core defense was unequivocal. The emails prove absolutely nothing other than the fact that President Trump did nothing wrong. She stressed over and over that the president had kicked Epstein out of Mar-a-Lago for being a pedophile and a creep.
And she used this politically charged moment to claim superior transparency over past administrations.
She actually claimed this administration has done more with respect to transparency when it comes to Jeffrey Epstein than any administration ever. She pointed to DOJ documents being turned over, but that claim was immediately challenged by reporters.
Right. They brought up that highly sensitive internal meeting where White House officials met with Representative Lauren Boebert to encourage her not to sign a petition calling for the release of more files. That seems like the opposite of transparency.
It absolutely does. And it put her on the defensive. So Leavitt responded by performing this rhetorical pivot, essentially redefining what transparency is.
How?
She sidestepped the question of why they discouraged the release of files by arguing that meeting with members of Congress to brief them on the topic was transparency. She asked the reporter, "Doesn't it show transparency that members of the Trump administration are willing to brief members of Congress whenever they please?"
So she reframes the act of executive control over information as cooperation.
Exactly. And the clashes over the Epstein files were so loud and aggressive that they immediately transitioned from political news into cultural commentary.
They became instant cultural fodder. Her responses were immortalized in a blistering SNL cold open. The parody highlighted her frantic efforts to avoid the core topic.
I remember the SNL character snapping back with things like, "You know you suck, right?"
The very fact that she was parodied in such detail shows that her persona, the aggressive, dismissive spokesperson, is now firmly embedded in the national consciousness. She's a major cultural figure, not just a policy mouthpiece.
And with that fame comes satire that can be mistaken for fact. I saw a satirical claim circulate widely online that she had told the media Epstein was talking about a different Donald Trump.
Which she never said.
No. Snopes, the fact-checking site, had to confirm it was satire. It just demonstrates how effectively her aggressive rhetoric generates and is sometimes mistaken for these absurd but politically useful extremes.
Okay, moving beyond the crisis management, her briefings are also packed with economic and ideological claims that form the core platform of the administration. Let's review those key policy messaging points.
Her economic message is delivered with absolute certainty. She frames the administration's policies as pure victory. She claims they've resulted in the largest middle-class tax cuts in American history.
And she gets specific.
Very specific. She talks about proposed cuts like no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, and no tax on Social Security benefits. She also credits the president with achieving American energy dominance, leading to gas prices being at a five-year low.
And she uses these powerful historical comparisons to support the claims, which adds weight to the perceived success.
Yes. She makes the bold assertion that wages are rising at the fastest pace in 60 years at the start of an administration. It's a huge claim.
That focus on deregulation is another constant theme. How specific is she about the scale of that reduction?
She provides this really eye-catching statistic. The administration has cut 30 unnecessary regulations for every new one on the books. Now, for you listening, it's important to contextualize this. This statistic is presented as a verifiable fact aimed at showing how they're saving employers thousands of dollars. The scale is designed to reinforce that central ideological point.
And that ideological battle extends fiercely to climate policy.
Oh, her rhetoric against climate policy is extremely hostile. She launched a direct attack on California Governor Newsom, calling the state's environmental policies a Green New Scam, and climate change itself a fallacy built on a utopian pursuit.
So her role isn't just to defend her administration, but to actively participate in the culture war against progressive policies.
Yes. But despite this aggressive certainty, she has also had to strategically tap the brakes on certain policy proposals that might be controversial or not yet fully vetted internally.
The 50-year mortgage proposal.
A classic example. When reporters pressed her on the specifics of creating 50-year fixed-rate mortgages, she was notably noncommittal.
She punted the question.
She did. She just said it was a proposal the president had commented on and that the administration was discussing and seriously looking into it. She deferred reporters back to the president's original, often vague comments. It's a strategic move that tells you the internal discussions were still happening.
Finally, let's look at how she defends the administration's stance on the Department of Justice, particularly regarding figures the president views as political enemies. This touches on that core promise of accountability and, well, retribution.
This is a core part of her advocacy. She asserts that the president is fulfilling his campaign promise to restore a Department of Justice that demands accountability for those who allegedly weaponized it against him. She specifically cites people like Letitia James and Adam Schiff.
She defends the president's public frustrations with the DOJ, framing them as justified.
She does. She argues his frustration is legitimate because these individuals abuse their oaths of office for political gain. So she frames any investigation into them not as political retribution, but as necessary accountability for corrupt politicians.
Okay, as we move toward wrapping up this deep dive, let's synthesize what this all means for the future of the White House spokesperson. Caroline Leavitt really represents a new model.
She absolutely does. Her political profile synthesizes the core beliefs of the movement. She publicly supports repealing Section 230. She maintains a firm anti-abortion stance. And while she acknowledges the 2020 election results were certified, she publicly stated her belief that irregularities and chaos occurred.
And that public fidelity is her unique value proposition. She is not valued for her ability to smooth over controversies.
No, her value is her willingness to perfectly transmit the president's hidden approach with the press, that long-running, deeply held view that the media cannot be trusted and must be actively confronted.
She sees her role as transmitting distrust, not building confidence.
Exactly. She told the Daily Mail that the president introduced the reality to the American public that you can't always trust what you read. And her job is to be the battle-tested bad cop who proves that point every single day.
It's like an interesting evolution from the traditional role, which I often sought to make the president appear presidential, you know, above the fray.
Mm.
Her job is to dive directly into the fray and amplify the conflict.
And she's doing all of this while managing immense personal pressure. We talked about her extremely brief maternity leave, but also the daily grind of the job.
She accompanied the president to the APEC summit in South Korea, for instance.
Yeah.
The travel is constant. The pressure is constant.
Yes, and that pressure is sometimes visible even in the small details. Well, at the APEC summit, she had a very Gen Z moment. She went shopping for K-beauty products, and she posted online about it, commenting that her skin has never looked better.
Which is interesting.
It is. Is that a fleeting moment of self-care or a calculated move to present a relatable contemporary image amidst the pressure? Either way, she has openly admitted that juggling the job, travel, and motherhood is incredibly challenging emotionally, physically, spiritually, and that she relies heavily on her husband's support system.
Her youth, her calculated social media, her personal decisions, and her unrelenting combativeness all feed into this single image of immense centralized power.
Which brings us right back to that label, the First Lady of Power. Her fierce loyalty, combined with her ability to command national attention, even through SNL parodies, and her capacity to dictate the media narrative, makes her an undeniably central figure.
Her career is completely intertwined with the administration's strategic decision to fight a political war through its communications staff.
And as long as the administration finds success in framing the media as the enemy, her role as the enforcer remains absolutely essential. It secures her position and her influence. She is the embodiment of the new political spokesperson.
A Gen Z press secretary whose life and career are under the microscope because of her youth, her personal choices, and her role as the primary combatant against the media.
And she's effective because she refuses to adhere to the old rules of decorum or transparency, opting instead for pure, unadulterated political warfare.
And that leaves us with a provocative thought, one that really challenges the very institution we've been discussing. Caroline Leavitt has made it explicitly clear that she sees her job not just as reporting news, but as fighting a political war. So if her effectiveness lies entirely in defining the media narrative as illegitimate, is the traditional nonpartisan role of a White House press secretary obsolete, replaced permanently by the figure of the political enforcer?
It's a huge question. If the spokesperson's primary goal is to generate partisan content and undermine journalistic institutions rather than to inform the public, then we are watching a fundamental and potentially irreversible shift in how the executive branch communicates with the entire nation.
A shift from briefing to battling, dictated by a fierce Gen Z loyalist, a transformation that will undoubtedly define this administration. Thank you for this essential deep dive.
Always a pleasure.